This is the Nichols Patrick Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of July 20th, 2015. Current federal tax developments are brought to you by Nichols Patrick CPA Incorporated and your State Society of CPAs. Let's take a look at what's happening this week as I'm broadcasting this week from the Mahoney State Park just outside of Omaha, Nebraska, down Interstate 80 between Omaha and Lincoln. And we've got a few developments this week, so we'll take a look and see how things have run. The first development this week is an issue regarding a challenge to the IRS's split dollar life insurance regulation in the case of R. County Home Enterprises, Inc. et al. Versus Commissioner. This is Tax Court Case 145 TC number 1. This particular case involves yet another welfare benefit tax shelter that fails in the end, so we'll give you the little hint at the beginning of this that this thing is going to fall apart. This is one of those claims where it was an attempt, like many of these, to use a welfare benefit plan of 419 Cap A to establish an ability to fund life insurance, permanent life insurance, for the owners of the business by getting a deductible payment into the account. And unfortunately, as often happens in these cases, that didn't quite work out the way they wanted it to. Now, this case is unusual, though, because we've had a whole bunch of these. Neonatology is probably the best-known case in this area that came down on a similar ruling with a similar result. But in this case, the IRS was arguing, and the court agreed, that the split dollar regulation applied for a number of the taxpayers involved. This was actually a number of cases combined. And the interesting part is that, because that's what's unusual in this case. The taxpayers in this case essentially said that the split dollar regulation shouldn't apply, and if they did apply, well, they were illegal anyway. So the question became, what do we have to do to look at a split dollar life insurance program under Regulation 1.61-22B2? To be a compensatory split dollar arrangement, because this arrangement wouldn't meet the normal test, but a compensatory arrangement must be one that was entered into the connection with performance of services, that is not part of a group term plan. The second prong requires the employer or the service recipient pay directly or indirectly all or any portion of the premiums. And the third prong, that either the beneficiary of all or any portion of the death benefit is designated by the service provider, by the employee in this case, or the employer's service provider has an interest in the policy cash value of the insurance contract. Now, the taxpayer claimed that they didn't meet either test 1 or test 3. The first test they claimed was that, this really should qualify as a group term insurance policy under Section 79 because, this plan, the amount of insurance that each one would receive if they died was actually set by them, was not set by the employees, it was set by the employer, and because of that there was, in any event, so there was not any sort of individual selection going on here, so there wasn't any impermissible amount that would be a problem with. Okay, that's their background. The tax court said no. The problem is here, we don't just look at the plan, we're looking at the underlying policies, and our question becomes where the policies have individual selection. And in these cases, it was clear that was true for the policies underlying the program. They were each employee's policy, and it wasn't just your standard group term policy that was in play here, that this was a very different program than your standard Section 79 program. Well, they agreed that the employer had paid the premium, so the second prong of the test was clearly met. But on the third prong, they claimed, the employees did not set the beneficiaries, and they didn't have any access to the cash value. Well, the court said, let's think about this. These people controlled everything. They could set anything. They controlled the plan. Controlling the plan, they controlled the designation of beneficiaries. And controlling that, they could do whatever they wish. Also, for all practical purposes, they had control of the cash value because they had the right to amend the plan at any point to change the vesting requirements. So if it turned out that for some reason they wouldn't vest, they could just magically, retroactively amend the plan and vest. So the court found that, in fact, the regulations applied. So next up, the taxpayer said, these regulations which require the taxpayer to pick up the computed economic benefit received for the year under the policy on the increase in value, they said, no. That goes against the whole basic gist of how tax law is supposed to work because the employees had no right to money at that point. And only at such point, they claimed that the employees actually had a right to go get money should they, in fact, be able to be taxed on it. To talk about that, the tax court went and took a look at the question of, okay, were the IRS's regulations reasonable? The reasonableness of regulations tests are governed generally by what's called the Chevron test. The Chevron test requires the IRS basically to be able to establish two things for a regulation to be reasonable, to be held to be valid. I should say not reasonable, but valid. Number one, the IRS has to show that in fact there was something to interpret, that the code was not crystal clear as to how this worked. And then number two, the IRS has to be able to show that their interpretation is a reasonable interpretation, not necessarily the most reasonable. The court then took a look at the definition of gross income under Section 61 and decided that it really didn't deal directly with this. It didn't tell us how we're supposed to measure income in this sort. And the court then found that the IRS's term in this case of deciding that it was that increase in cash value in a situation like this was a measurement of income, that in fact was the appropriate way to handle this. And so for that reason, the court found the regulation was a reasonable interpretation. Being a reasonable interpretation of an ambiguous statute, the regulation was held to be valid. Therefore, the taxpayers ended up with the corporations having a denied deduction and the employees being hit with these being employees of C corporations. They were hit with dividends, so there was no deductions at the corporate level. There was taxation at the shareholder level. Next up, we have a proposed reg here, Reg 135524-14, issued on July the 17th. And what this is doing is something the IRS has telegraphed for a while, and with some of the rulings had indicated that really this was coming. They're going to remove the requirement that an employee or other service provider attach a Section 83, a copy of the 83B election to their tax return when they file it. They'll still need to give the notice within 30 days to the employer and send a copy to the IRS. But the IRS is now stating that they're proposing to remove the requirement to attach it to the return. Even better at this point for us, when we look at this situation today, is that the IRS has decided that they're going to go ahead and say, well, we've issued these proposed regs now, and they are proposed, and they have an effective date for things happening after January 1st of 2016. But what they're going to say is, if anybody wants to, any service provider who wants to do so, can apply these regulations for any property received after January 1st of 2014. Or for practical purposes, that means 2015 returns. Now be aware, this early application does not mean that if you have a return that's on extension, you're going to be able to ignore the attachment at this point. You still have to attach it to those 14 returns you have left to do. But it does mean that next year we're probably going to see this go away. And again, the IRS has issued a whole number of private letter rulings recently indicating that failing to attach the election to the return was not a fatal flaw. And they've been discussing getting rid of it. Reality is now they've pretty much decided that, yeah, we should probably just get rid of this requirement. There's no real point in doing this any longer. Next up is a large business and international division memorandum, LBNI 04-0315-002. And it deals with, of all things, basically the electric generation industry, power generation industry. And you might think, well, I don't have any electric power plants as customer or as clients, so why should I be worried? Well, the interesting part here is, and it is dealing with a very specific rule, so let's take that caveat first. It's dealing with Revenue Procedure 2013-24. But it's important to remember that when the IRS issued the tangible property regulations, they had specifically in the preamble declined to give a percentage that would represent a major structural portion of an asset or a major portion of a major component for purposes of deciding if it had been replaced, for purposes of, you know, having to capitalize that replacement of the asset or that replacement of the major structural component. But it turns out that it wasn't just practitioners that wanted a percentage. Agents kind of like to have a percentage. And this is a nice percentage we're given. In this particular industry, interpreting this particular revenue procedure, the IRS agents were told when they were making changes, and this is a rev proc that allows those in that industry to make a change to a specified version that looks at significant components and looks at significant structural parts, that they are not to challenge the treatment of something as a substantial structural part if it makes up at least 80%, and they're not to challenge the failure to treat it as such a part for purposes of capitalization under the tangible property regs if it's less than 80% of either the major the component or the major structural part. Well, that's an interesting logic because that gives a percentage. Now, obviously, you can't use that percentage outside the industry with authority, but it does suggest that this the test here for when you're replacing a significant structural part or a major portion of a major significant component, it may be a much higher percentage than you might have expected from the IRS's refusal to name a number. So be aware, and it also gives you at least a discussion point if you have an agent who's claiming you have to capitalize something, when you can say, well, it's not a major component if that's your, or it's not a major structural part if that's your position, because it looks like, you know, in this industry, the national office concluded, or at least the LB&I division concluded that 80% was a test, and so you're going to have to talk about capitalizing under another provision, or at least you're going to claim they have to talk about it. Next up, we have the Ninth Circuit ruling in the case of Olive versus Commissioner, 139 TC number 2, which was affirmed by the Ninth Circuit in case number 13-70510 on the 9th of July. This is the case of a taxpayer who ran a medical marijuana dispensary. And the tax court had noted that under Section 280 Cap E of the Internal Revenue Code, generally, such dispensaries, anyone dealing in a federally illegal substance, which this will be a federally controlled substance, they're not allowed to claim any deduction for office expenditures or anything except cost of sales. And yes, I understand that seems like weird logic that they can deduct the one thing that the federal government said was illegal, but that is how the law is written. There are constitutional reasons why it was felt, Congress felt they could not leave out cost of sales, so they left cost of sales. But the dispensary appealed because they claim they ran two businesses, and this is the same issue they tried at the tax court. And the Ninth Circuit agreed with the tax court that no, while they may have offered lounge and they may have offered some consulting and they may have offered some counseling, they didn't charge for any of that. The only thing that was revenue producing was selling the medical marijuana. As such, they found they had only one trade or business. They found that it was not equivalent here to the situation in the California's Helping to Alleviate Medical Problems, Inc. case, where there the entity did show that they had an actual separate operations that dealt in areas other than medical marijuana dispensaries. They also went on and rejected one other claim that the taxpayer made in this case. There's been a lot of fight, as you may recall. A number of states have not only gone with medical marijuana now, but we actually have states that have legalized marijuana entirely, or at least effectively legalized it. And so, and Congress has in the budget stated that the law enforcement agencies can't expend funds to enforce the law in those states. You know, they're not supposed to be chasing after those or trying to criminalize the state employees, all those sorts of things. Well, the owner of this dispensary said, well, Congress's action there clearly means that Congress prohibited the IRS from enforcing 280 Cap E. The Ninth Circuit disagreed with that. First thing is, they said, the question here is not whether the IRS should have enforced it. The question is whether you violated the law. And as the Ninth Circuit said, if Congress wants to repeal this law, Congress has to repeal this law directly, not indirectly. Number two, the Ninth Circuit said, that in any event, they were talking about taking action against people who were selling and putting them in jail and charging them with crimes. Congress said nothing about enforcing tax laws in this area, and they obviously haven't touched the tax law. So the Ninth Circuit ruled that there had not been any congressional action that had changed the result in Section 280 Cap E situations. So basically, yep, the standard problem we've got, the same problem this guy had when he lost in tax court, continues here. Next up, we have a disguised sale partnership case. This is the case of Bosque Ranch LP et al. Versus Commissioner, Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2015-130, issued on July the 14th of this year. Now, this particular case is interesting because it's dealing with the disguised sales provisions that we find in the code, or that we find in the code and regulations under Section 707. Now, under 707, under Regulation 1.707.3b1, A transfer to a partnership is treated as a disguised sale, generally, if based on the facts and circumstances, the transfer would not have occurred had it not been for the subsequent transfer of another piece of property. And secondly, if it's not simultaneous, the subsequent transfer is not dependent on entrepreneurial risk. Now, in this case, the Boss Canyon Partners sold interest to new limited partners, and those interests they paid $350,000 apiece for. And after a period of time, they would receive a fee simple interest in a lot in this developed area, in this area they were developing. And that basically would take them out of the partnership. Now, the only hitch was that this was contingent upon the granting of an easement. And so the partnership claim, well, that raised entrepreneurial risk. So it was not a sale of lots of $350,000, but it was rather real partnership investments and then later redemption of the partners. What's the difference? Well, to the partners, probably nothing, because they have they put $350,000 in. Their interest in the partnership is liquidated, and assuming they got no allocation of income or loss, and certainly appears here they would not have, then what ends up happening at that point is they put all of their basis in the partnership interest into the property they received. So they still have a $350,000 basis in the lot they received. However, there's a big difference to the partnership, because if the partnership is not selling these lots, then the partnership is effectively transferring property. Transfer of property does not trigger gain recognition. So it's a big deal to the partnership, and so they were trying to get around having to recognize gain on getting rid of these lots. Well, the tax court noted that while they stated it wouldn't happen if the easement wasn't granted, it was clearly extraordinarily unlikely that wouldn't happen. And in any event, the actual general partners admitted under questioning that had it not really happened, when the court asked them, well, what would these partners then have done? What would you have been partners in? They admitted that in that case, most likely, they'd have just given them back their money. In which case, then, that's not a really good fact either for the court in this case. So what the court found was we actually had a disguised sale, and the partners in the partnership, not the limiteds because they were just getting their land, but the other partners in the partnership who got an allocation of income or loss in this entity were going to have to pick up a gain as each lot was sold. In essence, the $350 came in because there was a pure legal obligation. They were dressing it up, but it really was nothing more than a pure sale of lots to customers. And that sale of lot to customers is a taxable event. Next up, we have a reversal of the tax court in the case of Knudsen versus Commissioner, number 13720077, 2015 TNT 136-13, which reversed tax court memorandum decision of 2013-87 that came out in April of 2013. And this deals with that whole issue that came up back then of innocent spouse release under the equitable innocent spouse relief provision. As you may remember, back then, the IRS had been, the regulation stated that you could not ask for equitable relief from the innocent spouse provisions unless you filed within 2 years after initial contact. Well, the two-year rule applied to all of the non-equitable relief provisions in the code section, but the one that said equitable relief didn't say anything about 2 years. Taxpayers had argued, but unfortunately the court appeals level, not successfully, that the IRS was essentially not being reasonable by applying the two-year standard there, because, you know, equitable was supposed to be because we didn't meet the other items, and that could also be because we didn't file on time. Well, while the IRS won on that, they later decided to issue a notice here. And what they did was the IRS decided to walk away from these cases. So let's go to Knudsen and what happened there. The taxpayer in this case filed for innocent spouse relief. She clearly filed more than 2 years after the initial contact telling her that they were going to take the money, you know, they were coming after for collections. She made what is called a qualifying offer. Now, when they went to court, the IRS denied her innocent spouse claim. She filed in a tax court. They made a qualifying offer. They actually offered to pay it off for $50 per year for each of the 4 years in issue. So for $200, she offered to settle the claim. The IRS did not respond to her qualifying offer and it expired. Now, a qualified offer generally meets the following criteria. It's made by the taxpayer during the period beginning on the date that they received that the first 30-day letter is issued and ending 30 days before a tax court case is set for trial. It is specified the amount of the liability, so they did, $200. The offer is designated as a qualified offer. They told the IRS this was going to be a qualified offer. They're treating it as such. And it remains open for a period beginning on the date it is made and ending on the earliest of the date it is rejected, the date the trial began, or the 90th day after the offer is made. The IRS did not respond to this offer for 90 days, so now a qualifying offer is in place. The way the qualifying offer rules work is generally, if you make a qualifying offer, the case goes to trial, and the IRS doesn't win an award of at least the amount of the qualifying offer, then even though the IRS might have had a reasonable position, they still have to pay the attorney's fees and cost of the taxpayer because they forced a trial that actually didn't gain them anything. They couldn't gain them less than they would have gotten had they just settled. Now, the IRS, of course, made this concession. They conceded the issue. Generally, they issued a chief counsel notice, CC-2011-017, where they simply stated that they were going to have a change in their position, that they thought that they were going to have a change of heart, they're going to be nice guys, and they're going to change the reg, and if any case currently in tax court, they will withdraw their objection. The IRS agreed that if she had filed within 2 years, she clearly met all the other requirements that would be necessary to be granted equitable relief, and the service would have granted her equitable relief. So now they go back to court, and the IRS informs everybody of this. The tax court asked the party to go back and prepare a new set of stipulated facts for the court. Obviously, there's nothing for the court to decide at this point. So the IRS goes back and says, okay, we agree we're not going to go after the 2 years, so we're waiving the 2 year position, but we want you to sign off on this stipulation, and then we'll file an agreement. The taxpayer refused to sign the stipulation because, of course, the taxpayer's counsel realized that if it's a settlement, there's going to be no payment of fees, even though the IRS forced them through discovery and forced them almost all the way to trial. So they incurred a lot of expenses. The tax court, when faced with this question, determined that regardless of the fact that they hadn't signed off, the IRS's full concession on the issue was basically a settlement, and as a settlement, you can't get a qualifying offer award. The Ninth Circuit disagreed. The Ninth Circuit held that a settlement is and always must be a contract, and there was no contract in this case. The service merely throwing up its hands and saying, oh, we give up. Don't worry about it. We're not going to follow this anymore is not good enough. So the concession was not a settlement, and the Ninth Circuit sent it back to the tax court for a calculation of the attorney's fees and costs that should be awarded, but there's no question that it should be awarded according to the Ninth Circuit. This has been Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of July 20th, 2015. Current Federal Tax Developments is brought to you by Nicholas Patrick CP Incorporated. Be sure to visit our website at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com, where we'll have our updates each week for what's happening. Plus, we'll have all the source documents linked to for the cases we discussed here this week. And be sure to join us next week as we again talk about the developments in federal taxes for the coming week.